From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
I'm Mick Garrison. It's time once again for the fun size version of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And at my virtual side is producer Joe Russo to ask your questions of me on your behalf. Joe, how are you?
I am well, Mick. How are you?
Never better.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You know, we've got a lot of great questions this week, so you ready
for
to jump
change,
in?
Huh? Yeah.
We always get good questions. We always do. We always do. And though I will say it would be super helpful if moving forward, our great postmortemers would maybe hashtag AMA so I can find the questions a little easier. They're
yeah,
a little spread
a
out all over the social media verse. But I've gathered them and I've collated the best of the best. So
excellent. I expect nothing less.
All right. Well, here is a very timely one to kind of kick us off. Okay. Spooky WV asks, Mick, who would you cast to play yourself in the inevitable adaptation of Master of Horror, the official biography of Mick Garris?
Let's call that the least likely film adaptation ever to happen. I can give you a personal guarantee there will never be anyone playing Mick Garris, nor will there be a life story on any media other than the book.
I don't know. I mean, like,
yes, you do.
what if you could do like it would be like the Forrest Gump spanning story of horror, you know? You were there for all these moments, you know?
I think it's unlikely. I've played myself in a couple of small movies like Digging Up the Marrow and Brutal Massacre, but that's about the extent of my acting ability.
Well, I was going to say it would be great if we could get, you ever seen that photo of Steven Soderbergh with the long white hair?
Yeah, yeah, with the wig on.
Yeah, we should get him to do it. he can play Mick Garris.
Fair enough. Yeah, he's as much an actor as I am, I guess. No, he's actually carried one of his features all the way through. I forget which one the name is.
There you go. See, yeah. Perfect to play Mick Garris. But seriously though, congratulations on the release of the book. It's amazing.
Thank you. As we're recording today, this afternoon, we're going to be doing a big signing at Dark Delicacies with the author Abby Bernstein and a bunch of friends and coworkers who were interviewed for the book. So a lot of surprise guests. So it should be a good time.
I bet. I bet fans who hear this days after will be very jealous they missed it.
maybe not.
you never know. All right. Herkimer Homokia writes, quite a name. Are there any movie traditions Mick observes? For example, I just watched Friday the 13th on Friday the 13th. Mick, are there any movies that you watch religiously based on the calendar year?
Well, not generally. I'm not that much of a traditionalist, but I must admit, every summer we do watch Jaws.
Ah, so 4th of July.
Yeah, well, not necessarily on that day, but definitely during the summer, we will break out the Jaws. And now that it's on 4K, that's an even bigger treat.
Oh, I bet. And then on the 85-inch TV, I'm sure it looks great.
It kills.
Mark asks, Mick and Joe, can you recall the first time you saw Night of the Living Dead? And were you surprised by the ending?
Well, even though I was around in 68 when it came out, I didn't see it until a few years after. So, yeah, the ending was still devastating because it had not been spoiled for me. But it had been around in the genre magazines and people talking about it for years. And it just somehow I missed it on its initial release. So it was probably maybe 72 or so that I finally did get to see it in a theater. And I think some of its impact was diminished a little bit, the shocking elements, because it was for 3 or 4 years after the fact. Yeah. But it's still powerful and it's still iconic, and it did change the course of American horror cinema.
I wish I had seen it earlier on before, you know, I kind of went in knowing the legacy of it. You know, I'm sure we've talked about this a lot. Like when I was growing up, I wasn't really allowed to watch R-rated movies until, you know, I was well into my teenage years.
And, well, they didn't even have R-rated movies until 1968 when the motion picture code happened.
So, you know, horror movies when I was a kid were more like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, not watching, you know, Night of the Living Dead. But, you know, when I was late high school and in college, video stores started to do the rent 3 movies at a time thing. Right. And that's when I caught up on a lot of horror movies, and I saw it on video when I was in late high school. And I mean, it's amazing. It's still so powerful. I finally got to see it on the big screen at the International Horror and Sci-Fi Film Festival in Phoenix.
And, oh yeah.
And it's you know, it's one of the best for a reason.
If ever a movie was made for the theatrical experience, that's one of them. Most horror films, I think, work best in that collegial atmosphere where you're surrounded by the contagion of fear.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. But it was nice to be able to kind of watch Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead kind of literally all back to back.
Yeah, they were already all in existence.
They were all there. I could binge them. So before binging was cool.
That's right. Or even a thing.
I thought this was a really interesting question. Kent of the Dead asks, Mick and Joe, do you need a college degree to get your writing notice and sell a screenplay?
If you do, that's a big surprise to me because I don't have a college degree. I have a 2-year degree, but I never finished. I went to San Diego State University, but
you mean no one stopped you and said, Mick, we can't buy the screenplay because you don't have a 4-year degree?
Somehow that was the case. Yeah. you know, I think it's the creative arts are definitely a place where an education is not required, although any place you learn anything is helpful, whether it's the school of life or a university or traveling or whatever. The more you know, the better an artist you are, and the more you experience, the better an artist you are. But in this case, I don't think anybody is looking for a degree in screenwriting, because it doesn't mean that you're a talented screenwriter. It means that you went through the school system and got your degree.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the two sides of this coin are, one, going to college, you will be exposed to literature and movies and screenplays, and you'll be writing, and you'll be hopefully honing your craft of writing. But those are all things you can do outside of college too. There's no reason you can't be an avid reader and read screenplays and get better and better and write and write and write. So I don't think, you know, one necessarily helps the other. And I think, you know, if you're a great writer, you're a great writer, and no amount of schooling is going to change that.
It can help, you know, it can certainly help, because, you know, grammar does matter.
Yes, when grammar matters.
Yep. When somebody's reading a screenplay and it's filled with there spelled the incorrect way, the incorrect usage of there, or, you know, other examples like that. Mm-hmm. As a producer, when I was doing Masters of Horror and I was reading tons of scripts, if I was reading a bunch of grammatical mess, I would just toss it aside because I couldn't get through it.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Maybe I'm wrong. Quentin Tarantino, I believe, is another famous screenwriter without a college degree, right?
Right, and a guy whose grammar is not perfect.
No, because I think
Lawrence
Bender who like cleaned up his first script for him, right? Like that was the
he
typed it up and fixed all the grammar and
yeah. But the power of his writing is so great, and his dialogue mm-hmm. and his characters mm-hmm. and the momentum, that you can feel that on the page.
Yeah. Now, of course, he's the, extreme exception, right?
Yeah.
But it is possible. And no one is going to stop and ask, you know, where you went to school before they read your screenplay.
So. That's not been my experience that I've ever been asked.
Me neither. Demir writes, "Making Joe, some people have an agent, some have managers, some have both. What's the main difference between them? And do you need both an agent and a manager?"
It's a complicated answer because it's not the same as it was even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Agents and managers have kind of become very similar in their operation. It used to be a personal manager, the whole title is personal manager, worked more closely with you on your career and would read and give you feedback and mm-hmm. and take a personal interest in your career that was taken up more of their time than an agent who was there to mostly field calls, put you out for potential jobs, to know what writing and directing assignments were open and be even more connected. The major agency in particular, all those agencies would have a very strong connection to the studios and producers and independents and all. Managers were a little more specialized, but it's not been the case. There was a time where I had a personal manager, a business manager, an agent, and an attorney. And I no longer have an agent. I was with CAA for 20 years, and then I was with Paradigm for a while. And now I just have managers, and they seem to do the trick for me. Anything I would need from an agency, I seem to get from my managers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, and notably, you left your agency when the Writers Guild had a campaign against the agencies, and everybody left their agents that was in the Writers Guild. So I think
I found that my life didn't change.
Exactly. And that was what I was getting at, was I think a lot of writers discovered that their managers could do the jobs that the agents were doing, or maybe were doing them for the agents to begin with.
And legally, California law has that an agent can only earn 10% of your income, whereas a manager, until recently, it was anything they wanted. Some of them would take as much as 50% of their clients.
Oh my God.
Or unethical ones, but
yeah,
they've been reined in a bit. I think it's now down to 15 or 20% max.
It should be 10%.
It should be. And a lot of managers, if you're already represented by an agent for 10%, they will reasonably set their rates at 10%, but yeah, some of them still go up to 15 and 20.
The standard is 10% for the agent, 10% for the manager, and 5% for the lawyer. Exactly. That's the usual. So 25% of your money goes out the door if you have all three.
And if you have a business manager, that's either a percentage or a flat rate as well.
Oh my goodness.
Take care of the money end of things.
It's amazing anyone ever survives. The make it the nail on the head. I mean, your manager is supposed to be there to help you with the creative, and the agent's supposed to be there to help you take that creative and connect it to the people who will buy it. But the line is blurred, and it really kind of just depends on the person, you know?
Yeah. And my managers used to be agents. So
yeah. Same with mine.
One of my managers used to be one of the head agents at CAA from the time of its founding, but now he's with the management company, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's like I said, it's up to the person. And, my agent likes to give notes. My manager likes to beat the drum and go set meetings. You know what I mean? So like you never know. You never know. So there you go. There's the difference. And do you think, I mean, if you in a perfect world, I know you're happy with what they're doing, but would you ever consider signing with an agent again?
If I felt that they would offer more opportunities to me, then I would potentially move in with an agent as well. So far that's not happening, but I'm open to any possibilities as usual, because you never know what the next door opens to you will be.
There you go. You never know. All right. Peter writes, you've said before that your favorite way to write is to just start. No outline and let the characters create the story. But what kind of work do you do before you reach the stage of writing Fade In?
Well, if it's on spec, it's just been getting an idea that inspires me to sit down and do it. If it's something that requires research or is an assignment, I'll give you the example of Hocus Pocus. That was a story that was already created in the mind of David Kirshner, the producer. And I was brought in to be the first screenwriter on that. So I did a lot of research. I went to Salem, Massachusetts, and went to all those locations and learned a lot about the Salem witch trials of 1692. And did a lot of note taking and, books and physical excursions, and did an outline and then a breakdown and then a first draft and all of that. But virtually every time I'm writing something on my own, and my most recent spec screenplay is something that takes place in 1936. So I do some research on the subject in that regard. But if it's something contemporary and it's just a story I'm telling, I rarely do anything but, as our questioner inquisitor said, I basically just start, with an idea.
So yeah, it's so, I mean, look, I know there are writers like that out there. It still blows my mind every time I hear it, because I am an outline guy.
Well, you were a development exec too.
True. Yeah. No, so I guess I was kind of trained in expecting that. But I just feel like I need that roadmap, I kind of have to know where I'm going so I can connect the dots.
For me, it's more of an intuitive process.
Yeah, no, and that's amazing. Every writer is different. Every writer is going to have their own path.
Absolutely, and that's what's great about the creative process. No one creates the same.
No, they do not. But speaking of kind of work, you touched on research a little bit, but this next question from Ben, in prepping a story, has there ever been any research that you've come across has entered your daily life or blew your mind as something you didn't already know?
I wish. Probably the one would be Hocus Pocus. I mean, we come back to something that's almost 30 years old, as far as my writing experience of it. Just learning so much about the Salem witch trials and what happened here in this country in its infancy was pretty overwhelming. But does it affect my daily life? No, but it was quite a revelation for me.
It is pretty interesting, though, that in the current political climate, how mass hysteria is still very much a thing
Yes, the term witch hunt is as contemporary now as it was in 1692.
Absolutely, which that I guess is a little sad. I working on a project, you know, that hopefully will be going shortly. But you know, it was the character is a locksmith, and I don't know anything about locksmithing, so I had to do a lot of research to figure out, you know, how do you locksmith and how do you pick a lock and like what tools do you need. And so now I feel like I've learned all these things that I don't know if I'll use in my daily life, but
well, there's a career in crime waiting for you, Joe.
That's right. When everything goes belly up, I will I will turn to picking locks. But you know, I think it's important to do that research because that's how you get your characters to sound more authentic.
Absolutely.
So if you don't know it and you can't explain it, how do you expect anyone to buy it? You know.
Exactly. So. And the feel that it's lived in, that the character is a lived in character that existed before the opening titles and after the end credits roll. That's the whole point of writing and writing well.
Exactly. Rick writes, Nick, you've spoken about how another director was originally signed on to Sleepwalkers before being removed because he drastically altered the screenplay. I'm wondering if you're able to share what those differences were.
Well, I never read his rewrites, but the main one that I was told, and I was told this by Stephen King, was there was a journey to the planet of sleepwalkers. So if you can imagine such a thing, it could not be more far removed than the Norman Rockwell goes to hell quality of the movie as it exists and as was written by King. So, I don't know what else was in it, but that was a pretty staggering change.
I mean, he changed it to aliens, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I could see why that, would maybe ruffle the King's feathers.
Well, at least would make you not want to put your name in the title.
Sure. Yeah. And that was the big selling point, right?
Yeah. So. It was no longer King. It was somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting though, but they kept you away from those drafts.
Well, because it didn't have anything to do with the movie we were going to make. They wanted to make King's screenplay. They had some notes. And they got a writer director who could tend to those notes, mm-hmm. who could also make King happy as well as make the studio happy and be happy myself with having some creative input of my own in the development process.
So did they give you I guess it would be an older draft. They had you read that.
Yeah, there was one draft that King had done.
Right.
And then he'd done a little bit of tweaking, but mostly that happened after because this director came in.
Right.
And did his tinkering, and that was what set it all in motion.
Interesting. There you go. Well, that is the mystery solved about Sleepwalkers. And on that note, Mick, thank you for sitting down and doing another Ask Mick Anything. I know our fans love it, and I do too.
And so. Thanks to our listeners and fans, and keep the questions coming. And Joe, tell them where to send them so that they're not all over the internet.
You can send them to Mick on Twitter and Instagram at Mick Garris PM, or to me on Twitter at Joe Russo Tweets, or on Instagram at Joe Russo Graham.
That's great. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris on the Dread Podcast Network. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.